And in my interactions with other knitters, I often find that there are women in science. It's mostly women, not exclusively, of course. But there are women in science, there are women in mathematics, there are women in engineering who seem to gravitate to this because there's a lot of mathematics involved. It's not just, you know, the number of stitches, but how two pieces, right, you know, geometric shapes can fit together. In my instance, because I'm knitting from vintage patterns that were written almost 100 years ago for just one size, back then they assumed that women knew enough about knitting that if they weren't that size, they would be able to modify it.
Welcome to another episode of Innovation Insights, where we dive deep into the minds shaping the future of industries through innovation, creativity, and groundbreaking research. We believe that innovation happens in all aspects of life. I'm your host, Dr. Yolanda Sanders. Today, we are thrilled to introduce Billy Elias, a true innovator with over 20 years of experience in the educational toy industry. In addition to her professional accomplishments, Billy has an impressive background in fundraising for schools and hospitals. She has also brought joy and educational value to countless children and families. Billy's talents do not stop there. A lifelong genealogy enthusiast, she has spent decades unraveling the fascinating stories of her family tree and exploring history through meticulous research. Billy combines her engineering expertise, artistic flair, and love for detail to uncover hidden narratives, bringing history to life through old photographs, handwritten records, and family heirlooms. Beyond her professional and genealogical pursuits, Billy is an avid vintage knitter and storyteller. She inspires audiences with her love for creating timeless garments and shares creative techniques on her YouTube channel entitled Show and Tell Knitting. So whether unraveling the mysteries of a family archive or knitting her way through the styles of the 1930s and 1940s, Billy brings innovation, passion, and a deep curiosity to everything she does. So join us today as we explore Billy's remarkable journey, innovative spirit, and mission to create meaningful connections in education, history, creativity, and especially knitting. Billy, welcome to Innovation Insights. So happy to have you here.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
You're a knitter, and knitting has been a part of my life for the majority of it. When I learned about you and your work and your show, I was just enthralled. So thank you for being here.
My pleasure.
Would you tell us a little bit about your experience? Like, how... I think we're going to focus mainly on your knitting background in this, selfishly for me, because I'm just a lover of knitting. But how did you start knitting and when?
Oh, my goodness. It's one of my earliest recollections, and I can date it to age four and a half at the most, because my parents were still married and we were still living in the house where I had my first formative years of my life. After their divorce, we lived somewhere else. But I have very visceral memories of these, well, I still have the needles, turquoise celluloid needles that my mother taught me to knit with. They're about this long. They weren't specifically for children. There are needles. I have some above me, some vintage needles. There are needles that length that adults knit with. But I know I was very, very young when my mother taught me to knit.
Do you remember what your first knitting project was?
Oh, yes. I do. I made squares in garter stitch, which for those who are non-knitters, there's basically two stitches, the knit stitch and the purl stitch. If you only knit on the front and then again on the back and knit and knit and knit both sides, you will get something that does not look like this. You'll get something that's a little bit squishier, and it has a different feel to it. So I knit a a ton of garter squares with scraps of different color yarns, with the hope someday of assembling them into an afghan. By the time I had enough and was old enough to put them together, it was so unappealing to me that I think it went into the trash. Hey, that's okay. Yeah. Because, you know, the muscle memory was still there many years later when I came back to it. And I went on from there to do many, many, many work projects of much greater interest to me.
So it sounds like you took a break from knitting and then came back to it. What was the impetus for you to come back to knitting?
Well, more interestingly is why I took the break. I spent a lot of years in school. I went through a master's degree in engineering. So all those years that I was being educated, there really wasn't any time to knit. I went to an academic high school and then on to university and then graduate school. So, you know, my days were just full of learning, well, sort of, and we might get into my digressions from campus. But after that, I had a little time to knit, but then I started my career, so not so much. It wasn't until my child was born that I started knitting again. And then I took a big break raising him and came back to it a third time. So I've had distinct periods of my life where I was not knitting. But like driving a car, you know, if you haven't driven a car for 5 years, you're not in jeopardy of forgetting how to do it. So I didn't forget.
And you bring up something really interesting, being an engineer and being probably one of the few women engineers in your coursework and probably your work. But also, I love the connection between engineering and being a knitter, because I do feel like there's a lot of connections there.
There are many, many other knitters in the worldwide community. There are about 10 million knitters on a website called Ravelry. And in my interactions with other knitters, I often find that there are women in science. It's mostly women, not exclusively, of course. But there are women in science, there are women in mathematics, there are women in engineering who seem to gravitate to this, because there's a lot of mathematics involved. It's not just, you know, the number of stitches, but how two pieces, right, you know, geometric shapes can fit together. In my instance, because I'm knitting from vintage patterns that were written almost 100 years ago for just one size, back then they assumed that women knew enough about knitting that if they weren't that size, they would be able to modify it. Well, today we don't all have those skills. So that's where my engineering and math background really comes in handy. I can recalibrate what I need to do to get a sweater that fits me.
Oh, that makes sense. And that mathematical part, I think a lot of people don't realize how mathematical knitting is. Would you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. There are a few different types of fabrics that you can create. This is called intarsia, color blocks, but there's also lace, there's also cables, and there's different textures. A lot of those patterns are written with charts. I'm very comfortable reading a chart. Some people are not. You know, I've been reading charts like all of my adult life. But sometimes the charts have colors in them. That's not so hard. But sometimes there are symbols like a forward slash, a backward slash, a caret, a circle, and each of those symbols means something. You may have to go to a legend to find out what that symbol means, because not all pattern writers are using the same symbols. So that, I mean, that's part of where my background does come in handy. It's really comfortable for me reading the chart forward or reading it backwards, because sometimes you do have to do both, sometimes not. It depends on what you're creating. Sometimes the patterns are written with every row going in the same direction, but it can be very complicated. And I think it's very daunting for people who don't have my background. You know, they can do it, but it's not so facile for them.
That makes absolute sense. And then being able to calculate for different sizes. And so being able to take numbers and calculate to increase or decrease for sizes, as you were mentioning earlier, to fit around human.
Exactly, exactly. I mean, there are people who are tech editors who edit patterns and do grading to different sizes. I have not chosen that path. I'm a little bit of a selfish knitter. I just like to knit mostly for myself. So I don't get into trying to, you know, create it for other people to knit from. But yeah, I mean, and those people are certainly very good in math. And it's very interesting because, you know, you might have a 52-inch bust, but your neck might not be twice as large as my neck just because your bust is twice as large. Well, not quite, but certain parts don't change proportionately. You know, a wrist, even if you're a very heavy person or a very slim person, it's usually between 6 and 8 inches or so. It's not like 18-inch wrist because you're 300 pounds. No.
Thank you for saying that. Some of our audience members know that I've taught fashion design, pattern making, both flat pattern, draping, knitting. I've taught that too at the university level and privately. And that has also been something. It's like every podcast I get on my soapbox, and one of them is for this podcast, is that yes, the human body, just when you're trying to change a pattern to fit humans, like you said, you just don't get larger or smaller in all aspects. And so that's the beauty about knitting. And one of the reasons why I started knitting was because I've been this height since I was 11 years old. So I'm 5'9", and my fingertips almost touch my knees, which means I have really long arms. And so I couldn't find sweaters that fit me. I was really thin at that time. And so being able to manipulate and fit, and that's one of the lovely things about knitting.
Absolutely. As part of my motivation for knitting too, also because I like vintage, I can't find vintage clothes necessarily in my size, but I can make them.
Yes. And so vintage, you know, the area, the time periods that you love or focus on are 1930s and 1940s.
I love Art Deco, everything Art Deco. So that interwar period is of particular interest to me. And I try and do, not exclusively, but I try and do a lot of my knitting from those years.
So what is it about that time period that you love?
The geometry. The engineering aspect of it, transportation, airplanes, fast-moving trains, Zephyr, that kind of thing, and a lot of use of geometry in artwork. I think it appeals to the mathematician in me. I think that's it. Probably why I like American Art Deco more than French Art Deco or some of the other styles, because there's many, many categories of Art Deco. Some of them are very, you know, flowery. I like more the streamlined, they call it modern, more simplified.
So you see that the American Art Deco movement was much more geometric in form, motifs?
I think so. I mean, not exclusively, because even in this country, you have Miami Deco, it's different from Empire State Building or the Chrysler Building, which are our New York landmark Art Deco buildings. So even within the United States, there are different styles. But the ones that are the more geometric ones, the chevrons, semicircular things, the waterfalls, those are more my look.
And how does that translate to knitting and knitted garments during that time period?
Well, here is a perfect example. I've got, you know, triangles going down the front of the sweater and going down the sleeve. So, you know, I had to get the geometry in there. I didn't create this pattern, but But when I'm looking at patterns, I gravitate to things that exemplify that.
Yeah. It's a beautiful sweater. What is the fiber content of the yarn?
I believe this is 100% merino, so wool.
Yeah. Wool. Beautiful.
I prefer to knit with wool or other natural fibers as opposed to acrylic and polyester things because the properties are different. And then again, you know, having this background in science, I'm, you know, more fascinated by the materials maybe than somebody else. And the properties and the research that goes into, you know, do you want to use yak? Do you want to use cashmere? Because those are different animals than sheep that wool's coming from. And there are different properties. The stretchiness of it, you know, will it spring back? When you wash it, is it going to stretch out? So, you know, I'm always looking at those kinds of things too. But merino is very, very popular because it's soft and it's wonderful. It's not itchy.
It is wonderful. Your sweater is just beautiful. Absolutely.
Hello. Thank you. I mean, while we're on the topic of itchiness, I might just throw in because I do love to travel a lot and my knitting has opened up new travel destinations for me. Once a year, there's a big yarn festival in the Shetland Islands of Scotland, and I thought it might be interesting to go there as a part of the world that I hadn't been in. So I cajoled my husband into going with me. And I thought, oh, great. You know, it's an opportunity to buy like yarn practically like right off the back of the sheet. And there are a couple of brands that are really like famous worldwide that come from the Shetland Islands. So I went into the premier stores in the town of Lurworth that carry those brands. And they have a wide range of colors. P.S. I couldn't buy anything. Too scratchy.
Interesting.
It's not merino. It's Shetland wool. It's from a different breed of sheep. And it has different properties. And if you're knitting an outer garment that's not coming in contact with your skin, okay. But I have skin under this.
And do you feel like the breeds have naturally evolved to the breeds of sheep that the wool comes from and that in the Shetland area, it's coarser, heavier, probably because of the climate too?
I think because of the climate. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of rain and it gets quite cold in the North Sea area. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. But there are many, many types of breeds and I'm certainly not an expert, but other parts of the world are raising different breeds of sheep. Australia is a big place, and there are places in South America too. So, and we have sheep in the US as well. So, there are some brands that are completely from sheep to sweater created in the United States.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Oh. Yeah, I love that you travel for textiles. That has always been a motto of mine when my travels. I travel for textiles.
I've traveled for my other interests in the past as well.
Such as?
Decades ago at this point, but I left a corporate job to start my own business. And I didn't know what that business was going to be. So I thought the best thing I can do is spend 9 weeks in Africa and figure it out. And I did some research before leaving the States, what kinds of products are specific to some of the countries that I plan to visit. I considered for a moment industrial diamonds. My father was a chemist. I knew he would help me if I needed his help in that area. But I ended up traveling all around Africa. And what did I come up with? A very unusual line of jewelry made by African people. And, you know, it had like a real primitive kind of feel to it. And I thought, well, I haven't seen this in New York. It'd be interesting. So I started an import business. And really my motivation was, I'm going to be able to travel for business and I'm going to be able to write that travel off as a business expense.
Yeah.
But I felt like I got the best of all possible.
So which country was the jewelry imported from?
From South Africa.
Okay. Okay.
And it was back in the time where there was still apartheid.
Okay.
And my customers in New York were pretty savvy. And after a while, they said, Barry, can't you go to Europe and bring jewelry from there? Couldn't you go to Paris? And I was like, you bet I can. And then I researched, what's going on in Paris? Like, what's the scene there? And I learned about trade shows that took place where artisan jewelry people were coming and presenting their designs. And I found really unusual stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, these earrings are French. From when I was doing my importing. Again, a little Art Deco feel.
Absolutely.
They were made with original molds from the period, but they're made, in modern times.
Are those still available somewhere? I'm just you're asking for a friend?
My personal collection.
It's it. Totally.
So, yes, my business took me to Paris and Milan twice a year, every year for about 7 years.
Wow.
So that was a lot of fun.
Oh, I'm sure it was. I'm sure it was. What I love about talking with you is that your career and journey has been so varied, and working with young students or recent graduates from college, many times the goal is like, I'm going to have this career that goes like this. And I just plan out all these moves. And it sounds like you've had such various opportunities that you've taken. And you've been very entrepreneurial and innovative with how you've made career moves.
Well, just like your students, I had that thought as well. My entire life from maybe age 5, when I wasn't interested in playing with Barbie, I was more interested in building blocks and assembling models of things, more, early engineering related things, playing games that involved deductive reasoning, chess, and my favorite game was the lie detector game. Anyway, my whole life, I was building towards mathematics, my real passion for math. Through high school and then into university, I decided to look for engineering schools as opposed to liberal arts colleges because I really wasn't so interested in history. I was okay in foreign language, wasn't a great literature, Shakespeare and poetry kind of student, but I was really good in math. And I thought, if I go to engineering school, I won't have to take all those courses that are not of interest to me. I can really focus on career-oriented coursework. And it wasn't enough to get a bachelor's degree. I continued on to get a master's degree, and I started my career as an engineer, thinking, like your students, this is my life. This is what I was cut out for, and it's fascinating to me, and I'm all in. Well, about 8 years into the game, I realized it really wasn't for me. It really didn't suit my personality. I detested wearing pantyhose every day. And this was before people were putting on sneakers to walk to work. I was wearing pumps, heels, every day up and down the subway, all through the day, out to lunch, whatever. I was young, so I could do it, but, it got old pretty fast. And then the environment that I was in, corporate environment, mostly working with men, wearing business suits. I had to wear a business suit just like they did. And I had to fit into that, cookie cutter kind of mold. There's really, no room for creativity or originality. This is the way it's always been done. This is the way we're going to do it. The hierarchy. I mean, in no time at all, I was at the glass ceiling and I thought, I'm devoted to the company, but what about me? I matter. So I was still fairly young in my late 20s when I decided I'm out of here. I'm going to go out on my own and see if I can make it. And it was still going. You know, it wasn't a magic bullet in any sense. But the freedom of being able to be my own person and laugh whenever I wanted to and jump up and down wherever I wanted to, like, I just felt like I was myself. Now, there were early signs of this when I was at university because I came from Philadelphia to New York.
For school.
And, you know, when you're on a campus that's in Manhattan, you're really a subway ride away from some of the greatest cultural institutions in the world. And I thought it behooves me to explore these places because I'm pretty sure after I graduate, I'm going back to Philadelphia. So in my 4 years, I made it a point to visit practically every museum and get to the theater and get to the opera and the ballet. And some of my classmates were interested in doing those things with me, but a lot of the times I just went on my own. And even today, I do like to go to the museum by myself because I can go at my own pace. It's sometimes hard. Sometimes my husband and I will go, or I'll go with a friend. And, you know, they want to move on ahead. But I have found, like, Frank Sinatra, like, I like to do it my way. And those signs were there probably earlier on, but I didn't pay attention to them because I thought, I'm going to be an engineer, and I'm going to be the rare woman in engineer, and I'm going to be really sought after, which I was. But, you know, after a time, things started to even out, and then a lot of jealousy of me because I was a woman and I didn't have a family and I could do whatever I wanted. My male colleagues, I think, envied that. And I can't specifically say they were trying to hold me down, but it's subtle. You know, you're not a member. It may be different today. I certainly hope it is. But you're not a member of the old boys network. You're not going to the country clubs that they're going to. You're not playing golf. You're not, you know, doing the things that they're doing. So I felt like it was going to be, you know, a rough road. And my father was a little disappointed because I did have all of his training and a lot of education. And he felt like, well, that's going in the garbage can. And I said, yeah, but Dad, those skills will serve me in everything I do. And they have. They have. When I'm doing my genealogy research, I feel like I'm a good researcher. I'm thorough, and I know how to ferret things out. A lot of the stuff that I did when I was really involved in genealogy involved looking at old documents. And sometimes those documents were handwritten in foreign countries where script is not like the script that we're used to seeing here. I mean, think about our own Constitution or the Declaration of Independence, things that were, you know, written with pens, feather pens or whatever. Sometimes they're hard for us to read. It's not familiar to us. Well, that's kind of like what I was looking at. But for me, it was like a jigsaw puzzle. It's like the kind of puzzles that I was used to doing and, you know, figuring out problems, piecing together letters and saying, well, you know, maybe it's this. And maybe if I try this, it might be a little better than that. Just one example. A lot of things are transcribed today by people. So they're taking script and they're trying to translate it into text that a computer can read. Well, depends on who did that transcription. My grandmother's name came out to be something completely different. Several of her letters were different letters. And I was looking for her, searching databases, using, you know, text, and not finding her. Well, I knew she came to this country. And, you know, I knew that. I knew she wasn't born here. And I couldn't find her ship manifest because I simply couldn't find her name the way they were transcribing it. But then I started guessing and looking more deeply, and boom, I found. So there's that. There's also the stick-to-itiveness. You know, I'm not satisfied until the problem is solved. And that, I think, is part of my training. And I apply that to practically everything I do in my life. If it's planning a vacation, if it's knitting a sweater, if it's designing my, well, I'm hoping to redesign my kitchen. It all always comes together for me because I can measure things accurately. And that attention to detail. So all these changes, yeah, it's made for a really interesting life, and I have no regrets. So if you have students watching this or people early on in their career, that would be my message to them. Just because you think you're going one way, the world is still your oyster forever. And if you're not happy where you are, then you should really look to make changes that will make you happy. Because for me personally, money is not the only thing in life. Happiness trumps that for me any day. And once I was able to like really focus in on what do I want out of life, I want to be happy. Of course, I want to be healthy too. But more than having a lot of money, I have enough money. You know, more is always nicer. I could go on better vacations, stay in nicer hotels. Okay, you know, not worry when I'm making my travel arrangements. I have to like keep looking for the cheapest flight until I drive myself nuts. So yes, having a certain amount of money to be comfortable, but beyond that, like these guys who have, you know, 50 billion, I don't think they're having a better life in it. Like, you know, a million times better than my life. I don't think so.
Well, you definitely seem to be happy and having a great time. And I so appreciate the gems that you've dropped for our audience, regardless where they are in their career, that it's never too late to change. And you can, if you're not happy doing what you're doing, then do something different. But I also love what you've said about problem solving. And that seems to be one of your core skills, abilities. And I've always believed that engineers and designers are probably closer to each other than not. And that problem solving is one of those big skills. And I also feel like leaders need to have that skill too. And so thank you for sharing how problem solving and that ability to solve problems has threaded its way through so many parts of your life. And I guess that was a pun, or yarned its way through so many parts of your life. That was a bad joke. Okay. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
No, it has. It's true.
Yeah.
Problem solving, it has served me very well.
Yeah. So 8 years into your job as an engineer, and you decided it's time to make a change. And is this when you started the import business?
Yes.
Yeah. Hey.
Okay. Yes.
Wow.
Really like diametrically opposed to what I had been doing, but it was another facet to me. I guess I should give my parents some credit here because I am a product of them. And it's really clear. I know that it wasn't the milk who impregnated my mother, because my father was a scientist. I've already mentioned that. He worked on the Manhattan Project, I'm very proud to say. My dad was an unbelievable man, brilliant man. And my mother had a very wonderful life. In fact, if I can give a plug, I wrote a book about her.
Oh, I love it. Pearl's Party?
It's called Pearl's Party and You're Invited.
Love it. Love it.
With nothing more than a high school diploma, she had a fantastic life. She was the life of the party. She enjoyed life to the max. And I'm talking about eating, drinking,
and other things that I don't know about, but like a party animal. And she was street smart, but she was artistic. When I was very young, she made a sculpture of me. She did a bust of my head. It's like somebody took a cast of my head and, you know, created it from this mold. It's like so perfect, including the little eyebrows, the little ponytail, the lips. I mean, everything is just really, really accurate. So I got both. You know, I got the art side and I got the science side. What do you do with that? Well, you could be an architect. I didn't think I was creative enough. I mean, I saw the guys in architecture school and the models that they were making and the things that they were thinking of. And I thought, okay, like, I don't think I could do that. Plus, I think you need to know physics a little better than I did. So, you know, I just like eliminated that whole field. Today, I regret that nobody like informed me that you could go to architecture school and be something other than an architect. You could be an architectural historian. There's all these different fields that nobody tells you. And sometimes even after you're out in the real world, you don't know. But I probably would have loved that because I love architecture. I love the artistry of architecture. And then I love the science behind what makes it stand up or fall down. So, yeah, I kind of missed that boat. But okay, you know, I realized that I had some modicum of creativity. I don't consider myself a really creative person. I'm a creator, I'm a maker, but I'm not creative, I don't think. Like, I don't have, you know, that vision. In my little niche, yes. Like, what sweaters I want to knit, if you show me 1,000 patterns, I can pick out three that I really like, and I can execute them, and maybe my choice of colors. But, you know, I know that there are people who can take a piece of wire, like Alexander Calder, and make it into something fantastic. That's not me. Like, so I really don't consider myself creative. But I have a good eye, I think. And I enjoy looking at art. So I have, you know, some level of appreciation. And then, you know, couple that with everything else. And it's a whole lifetime of, you know, building up a wide array of experiences. And yeah, it's all been great. And I wouldn't look back. Now, I know at the beginning you mentioned that I was in the toy business. Yeah, I was for a big chunk of my life because when my child was born, I didn't really want to be working outside of the home. I wanted to be staying home with him. But, and I still wanted to generate some income, and I still wanted to do something that would keep me engaged with other adults. So this sort of fell into my lap because my sister-in-law was selling these educational toys, and she gave us gifts for our baby. And I thought, these toys are really great. I bet some of the other moms in my mommy's group would love to have them. And then before long, I found myself in a new business. I had abandoned my jewelry business because I just couldn't physically. It was too jewelry's heavy, you know, can't be if it's metal. So I found myself in this new business where I could take my baby along with me to sales appointments and whatever, because it was real family oriented. People were fine that I had my baby in tow. And I could work from home. I could do a lot of stuff on the phone and on computer. It was really great for my child to see an entrepreneurial mom who, you know, figured out a way to make it work and generate some income and still be playing with him a lot. So that's like another chapter of my life. There have been several. And then I got really tired of doing that after 20 years. And it was physically harder and harder for me, like going out with my toys and setting up displays in churches and private schools and so forth, you know, showing
toys to people who were working with children or parents who needed this kind of product. You know, it was wonderful. And I worked for a great company who had incentive trips. There's that travel again. I want to go to really great places because I earned some of the incentive trips. I went to Rio de Janeiro with them for all expense paying days with a group of hundreds of other people who had also earned the trip and their spouses. So, you know, Rio, we went to Maui, Vienna, Paris, the places. Why am I not remembering the Bahamas?
Wasn't.
That wasn't so exciting to me. Anyway, so, you know, if there was travel, that was a big carrot for me.
I don't blame you. And I think sometimes, too, young professionals don't realize that could be a part of the benefits of being in the workforce is that opportunity to travel various places that you might not get that opportunity to if you're not working.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, you said you went in and out of knitting as part of your life, and then, you know, you're really back into it now, and you have this wonderful YouTube channel. Tell us about that, and how did you start that, and why?
I think it was about a year and a half before the pandemic that I decided, okay, my son is grown. He's out of the house. He's on his own. He's set. I have time on my hands again. I'm really retired, and I'm looking for something to engage me. And I thought, well, you know, maybe I should think about knitting. Some of my friends were knitting, and I thought, you know, I like what they're doing. And I remember how much fun it was. So I went to a local yarn shop and I said, you know, I have knitting needles at home, but they're buried somewhere. Can I borrow a pair of yours? I want to buy a ball of yarn and I just want to sit at your table and see if I can remember how to cast on and how to knit. Because it had been at that point about 25 years, I'm going to say. And as I described earlier, it came back. It came back slowly at first, but within like 5 minutes, I was up to speed. It connected in my brain. And there I was working at the same speed that I felt I had always worked in the past. So I bought yarn to make a sweater. I had seen a pattern online. I bought the pattern from men, bought the yarn, came home with the sweater. Fast forward about a year and a half, in February 2020, we locked ourselves in ahead of the rest of the country because at that point, our son was working for a think tank in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and they had heard about the COVID virus and were starting to research. We really didn't know much about it yet. It really hadn't hit New York much yet. But within a short time, you know, a couple people died and then there were more. Well, anyway, he made us lock ourselves into our apartment. I don't know anybody else who did what we did. I put masking tape all around the front door, sealed us off. We never opened our door for about 4 months. I didn't empty the garbage for 4 months. I'm fortunate I have a terrace right here. I had garbage bags. I kept putting our garbage in the garbage bags out on the terrace.
Seal. How did you get food?
Didn't empty the mail for months. Food, I loaded up our freezer and our cupboards with canned goods and frozen fruits to last us for a while. I mean, after everything wound down from the pandemic, I still had cans of pumpkin. Lots of cans of pumpkin. It was cheap. It was nutritious and was going to last a really long time. So I bought a lot of that because you could mix it with other things. Anyway, January of 2020, there was a big festival in New York. It happens every year for yarn manufacturers to present their goods. It's a big, you know, they have courses in knitting. It's a big knitter's paradise called Vogue Knitting Live. And I happened to have bought quite a bit of yarn at that show. Yarn for an entire sweater, not this sweater, and a coat. So I like plenty of yarn to keep me busy while we were locked in. And I started knitting. And while I was knitting, I felt like, well, I could really multitask, or I could do something else while I'm knitting. So I started watching videos on YouTube. And before long, I think YouTube started serving me knitting videos, because maybe I watched one or two. And then I saw, oh, all these people are doing like podcasts about their knitting. And I thought, well, maybe I could do that. So I started with the camera that was in my computer, the microphone that was in my computer, and it was really low quality. If I were to do it again, I would never do it that way. But that wasn't until later on, after we unlocked our apartment. It was in August of 2020 that I started my podcast. But by that time, I had knit quite a few things. I had, you know, stuff to talk about and stuff to show. And about once a week, give or take, since then, I've come out with a new show where I talk about what I'm knitting. But more interestingly, I found that there are other people out there somewhere in the world who are also interested in vintage and are also knitting from vintage patterns. So I started reaching out to them. You know, I found them on Instagram, or I found them on this Ravelry.com that I mentioned. And I would ask people, would you be willing to come on my podcast and talk about your sweaters that you've knit? And I won't say that everybody said, oh, yes, I'm thrilled to do it. A lot of people said to me, I'm very bashful. English isn't my first language, whatever. I mean, I did eventually get some of those people, but anyway, including one woman who was so timid that I think she was actually shaking. But after a while, you know, she became more comfortable, and she had fantastic stuff to show. Every single person I've had on as a guest has had incredible things that they've knit. And it's so interesting, you know, in different parts of the world, people are doing similar things. It's like fascinating to me, but always with their own individual twist, you know, their choice of yarn, their choice of color, whatever. So, yeah, one thing led to another, and little by little, you know, it's grown. And it's a lot of fun. I mean, it's just, you can see some of my yarn in the background. I'm all set up for the next guest.
Well, it's a fabulous show, and I really encourage our audience to check out Show and Tell Knitting. It's just fabulous, and I learned about you, Billy, through one of your guests, Dr. Susan Strawn, and she had was coming onto my podcast, and then was telling me that she was going to be on yours, and I was like, oh my goodness, and so I was just really impressed, and that's something right now, we have the creator economy, and so many people that are, they have their own podcast, they're building their brand that way. Would you tell us a little bit about your journey with that and what that has been like?
Building my brand?
Uh-huh.
Well, I remembered in early, like, elementary school that we used to do show and tell. And I still have one of the objects that I brought to school for show and tell. My mother had gone to Puerto Rico, and she always tried to bring me back some little souvenir. Sometimes it would be castanets. She would go to Puerto Rico a lot, like once or twice a year, it seems. But early on, she brought me back this thing that were like shells of some nut that were wide and flat. And it was rigged up kind of like a yo-yo, but on a stick. You pulled the string and it goes zoop back into the shell. And then you pulled the string and it goes zoop back in. So I remembered enjoying show and tell, and I thought, I want people to come on my show and show their stuff and tell me about it and tell other people about it. So I thought, okay, I'm going to call it show and tell, because I think that kind of, you know, is what it is. And I remember that being fun. Well, you know, something that hasn't come up at all. Yes, you know that I love the 30s and 40s. Well, I love everything about the period, including old movies. It's right. Cut board. So for a while, like, that became part of my brand, that I would start my show with the clapboard and say, you know, and action and, you know, roll on, and I would talk and then I would introduce my guests. So that became sort of the brand. And then I put a movie marquee around all of my thumbnails. So, you know, when you're looking for me on YouTube, there's this black frame with little white light bulbs, if you will, going around the border. So you can find it pretty easily. I think that's about it. Although in some episodes, I do weave in something about movies. Maybe I saw somebody wearing a fabulous sweater in a movie. Often I see knitters in movies. In fact, I've made, I think, one or two episodes that involved not me and my knitting, not a guest, by knitting in movies or movie stars knitting. So I do have this little, like, knitting theme that winds through movie land, too. So I, you know, I guess that's also a little part of my brand because it's that time period. You know, it's like the golden days of cinema, besides all the, you know, other art forms. So
I love how you've taken two areas that some people would be like, movies and knitting, what does that have a relationship? And you've built your brand around that. So ingenious. And you've thought about the visual aspects of it. And one question I have for you, do you always wear pieces that you've knitted in your episodes?
Well, when it's 20 degrees outside, you bet I'm wearing a sweater that I knit. I do own other sweaters, but my closet is filling up with things that I've knit. I've knit probably a couple dozen sweaters since the beginning of the pandemic. So I can't say always, but yeah, a lot.
Yeah. That's great. That's really great. It's so well. Yeah, why not? Yeah, it is so well thought out. Wow. I do have a question for you about innovation. How do you define innovation?
To me, innovating is about creating. It's about creating something that hasn't been done before. I mean, I think when we say somebody's innovative, I think generally that's what we mean. They're doing something that's fresh and new. So I think that that's it. And you know, maybe I might add, with a vision of how this thing that you're creating will move people forward. You know, I think there has to be some future with the innovation. It's not like do it now and it's over tomorrow. I think there's this vision of where you're going with that innovation that's part of being innovative too.
I like the inclusion of the vision and moving forward. Sometimes you hear innovation as a buzzword and you're like, just innovate, just to innovate. I guess you could, but.
It'd be easy. And, you know, I don't know that everybody is capable of doing that. But in our country, we have people like Bill Gates or Steve Jobs who were really innovative. Steve Jobs in particular, you know, to have this vision of, well, everything is going to be, you know, I this, I that, iPad, iPhone, all right, yeah. And the styling of it, completely different from what everybody else making computers was doing. So, you know, there was that creativity aspect, but giving people a product that they didn't have before, that they didn't really know they wanted or needed. I mean, now, like, who doesn't have a computer?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And so that human aspect of thinking about humans, what they need, what they don't know that they need. And you've done a great job with that too, with bringing back show and tell to the knitting world. Just thank you for being here. It's just been delightful to get to know you and having this conversation with you. And I want to have you back again because I know that you have millions of stories and it's just fascinating.
Well, you live long enough and you can reinvent yourself many times. And each time it was a completely new experience. It's been great. I mean, I hope I have more things to come, but it seems like I'm pretty settled into knitting and maybe I'll be able to knit for the next 20 years and I should live that long.
Let's hope that you do and that you continue knitting. And as you said,
as fingers, no arthritis, make sure, you know, they stay good because without this, there's no knitting. There's machines.
Right.
I don't want to do that. You can't carry the machine on the airplane like I can carry my knitting needles, which, by the way, TSA regulations say that you can carry knitting needles on the flight. So
thank
one little factoid. Another good search.
Thank goodness. Yeah, there was a time where you couldn't. I was traveling during that time. I remember one time I had a group that we were taking to India and some of them were wanting to learn to knit on the trips. We encouraged them to bring their knitting needles. And we had a few times that we had some challenges with the knitting needles, making sure that they was able to get onto the plane. And especially
it's ridiculous.
Yeah.
This is just as sharp and pointy and dangerous as my knitting needle. Absolutely. I can carry this on. Nobody's going to question that.
No, I know. I know. Oh my gosh. Thank you for being here.
You're welcome.
And just again, we'll have you back. I'll be bothering you again because I know you also have some really great trips ahead of you too that we've talked about in our prep meetings. I'll be bugging you.
Okay. I won't talk to that. So I'll have much to tell when I come back from Paris. Oh my goodness.
I know. You can't wait. I can't wait to hear about it.
Yeah, well, either.
So our audience, thank you for joining us today. Please explore her YouTube channel, Show and Tell Knitting. It's really fabulous and well produced. And those of you that are thinking about your own personal and professional brand, Billy has it down. And just the inspiration around problem solving, creativity, curiosity, taking unique turns in your life. So please follow her. And if you enjoyed today's episode, please subscribe, leave a review, leave a comment, share it with your network. Please stay connected with us at Innovation Insights for more stories where we celebrate creativity, professional growth, and this the entire spirit of innovation. Until next time, keep innovating, keep dreaming, and keep making a difference.